in here, or is that just for the camera?
Yes, two speakers here, yep.
Okay. Can you hear in the back? Good morning.
You probably should pick up the microphone if you can, though.
Oh, I need to pick it up and talk into it, is that better? All right, then I said good morning. Happy to be with you all. I'm going to say just a couple of words by introduction and give you a clue of why we handed this out, and then let George do a brief kind of intro to the cognitive science involved in framing. Then we're going to do an exercise with this. But first let me restate kind of what, or my own terms, what Dale said, because I still struggle with this too. After close to 20 years in journalism, and most of that in political journalism, in the Capitol Bureau of the Houston Chronicle and the dearly departed Houston Post, and I still kept my hand in journalism with a regular column in the Austin American Statesman, and I missed it as a full-time profession, I have to tell you that. But I spent many years since I left actual daily newspaper and as a consultant doing Democratic campaigns, working for progressive organizations. So I've been on kind of both sides of this fence. I spent two wonderful years in Berkeley with George at his think tank, working on these framing issues, and two of the most fascinating years I've had in my life. So I really enjoyed that, George. I wish we were back at it. I just want to say a couple of words because about the exercise we'll do after George's introduction. What's difficult as a journalist in approaching the way issues are framed for you is you are given a certain kind of raw material to work with, right? You're getting quotes from one side, quotes from another side, facts and or alternative facts from one side or the other, and that's the raw material you have to work with. If you think of a metaphor to filmmaking, those are the shots. That's the footage you take into the edit studio. You can't make up new footage. You've got this footage. You've got these quotes. You've got these facts or alternative facts. You've somehow got to find a way of telling the story with this material that gets beyond the spin given to you by one side or the other. And I promise you, as you probably already know, almost everything somebody tells you is a self-serving comment, one way or the other. I'm not, as an advocate for the environment, necessarily going to tell you anything good for the climate deniers, right? I'm going to tell you what I think helps my side, and the same is true of the other side. The job of the journalist, however, is to cut through that and tell the story in one way the public can understand it, and two, cuts to the truth of the matter. And I wasn't trained to do that when I was trained as a journalist. I was trained to get the quotes and put the quotes in a story in a reasonably organized fashion so that people could understand what people say, and just do, assuming, as Dale said, that consumers of news were rational actors who, if given the facts, would reason to the right conclusion. Well, we now know that's not even close to the truth. So you have to engage them in a story that penetrates the raw material you're given and gets to the truth of the matter. After George's introduction to the science of framing, we're going to do an exercise with these quotes from the two sides in which I'll ask you to, you can do it two ways. You can analyze this from a perspective of George's framing introduction, or you could attempt to do a story properly framed to get to the truth, cutting through the quotes from each of these sides on the new administrator of the EPA. I'll leave that up to you, but we'll get to that after George's brief introduction of the science of framing.
Is this working? Yes. By the way, this is going to go on for a while, and we're hoping to learn a lot from both what you know that we don't and from your questions, because your questions tell us things that we don't think of. And so we're here to learn things, not just, this isn't a one-way communication. Let me just begin with a simple framing example. President announced that he wanted to get rid of three-quarters of the regulations in the government, these horrible regulations. And if you go and look up regulations online, what you find out is a lot of quotes from corporations. That is, they say there are these regulations that are that impose on our freedom, that are burdensome and costly, and we got to get rid of them. Now, there's another side to this that isn't from the point of view of corporations. If you shift it from those people who are powerful to the people who are not powerful but affected by them, you get the idea that that regulations are protections. That's why they're there. You go to the EPA. Why do they make up the regulations? You've studied how regulations are made and so on. but they're there for the public good. They're there to protect people. And that's not just there. It's there in the Food and Drug Administration. It's there in the SEC. It's there all over the place. The so-called administrative state, that is, the folks who administer the laws, are there to say, okay, if you got a Clean Air Act, you know, how much, you know, where is it clean? What does clean mean, et cetera? And they're there to protect people. That's what regulations are about from the point of view of people, not the point of view of corporations. Those are two different framings of the same thing, except if you want to call them the same thing, of a single issue. And I want to mention that simply because viewpoint matters. There's no way that you could say that either of those is neutral. And that's very important. I occasionally give lectures. I'm asked to give lectures at the journalism school at Berkeley. And what invariably happens is that after about the first 10 minutes, somebody raises his hand and says, that's the opposite of what we're taught. We're taught that language is neutral. We're taught that you can just, you know, say words and they fit the world. Who, what, when, where, why. And the point is, it is not true at all. Language is not neutral. All language is dependent on frames. This is one of the basic things that Charles Fillmore, who's figured this stuff out in the 1970s, noticed, that you can't, any word at all in any language is defined relative to a conceptual structure called a frame, and we can go through its, and frames have structures, I can go through what they are later. But if you think about it, just take a simple example, a restaurant frame. You go in there and you have elements of a frame. You have waiters, you have menus, you have chefs, you have places to sit down, you have meals, you have bills and so on that you pay. There are things you think are going to be there. You don't expect to walk into the restaurant and there's a waiter on the table being operated on and saying, well, you're supposed to pass the scalpel. No, that's not what is happening in the restaurant frame. That's the surgery frame, something different. And the point is that frames have a structure. They have elements called semantic roles, like waiters and menus and so on, and relationships between them. And other things don't enter, or some things may enter or not, and there are variants on frames. There are dim sum restaurants that work differently, and fast food restaurants work differently, types of restaurants. But in general, there is a single frame for these things and for each of them and for the variations. And what happens is that the words are always defined relative to frames. And that may depend upon your worldview. It's not the same for everybody, as we saw, with regulations and protections. So now, let's go back a little bit. To understanding this, you need to go, believe it or not, into neuroscience. I'm finishing a book called The Neural Mind right now. And for the last 25 years, we've been working with people doing neurocomputation and cognitive linguistics and neuroscience to figure out how you get ideas out of neural circuitry. And it turns out that in 40 years, we've learned a huge amount about it. Basically, ideas do not float in the air. They're not just floating around like viruses, right? They are all in your neural circuitry, right? You can't do it without your brain. And it's not just your brain. Your brain is connected to your body. So it is not possible for all thought to be in the brain. Because if it was not connected to the body, what would you think about? Nothing, right? You got to go through your eyes and your what you feel and, you know, what you hear, et cetera, through your body to get information at all. And it turns out that that matters because the structure of your body affects the structure of thought. I won't go through that in detail. We know a huge amount about that, however. Now, but the point is this. If all ideas are there in your neural circuitry, what happens is some of them, when the neural circuit is activated, it gets stronger. And some of them get stronger, stronger, and stronger throughout your life. And what you wind up with is a worldview of relatively fixed ideas. When you go around in the world, you have an understanding of what it is that you're seeing, in terms of just ordinary everyday stuff, like restaurants, for example, or newspapers, which is a very different kind of ways of understanding things. But you have an ordinary way to do that. But it turns out in politics, you have different worldviews. And that's important, and we're going to get into that. That is, you see the world differently depending upon your worldview. Now, that is important for several reasons. First, most thought is unconscious, about 98%. That's the best estimate people have. It's not, it could be 97, 95. It's not quite clear how you measure it, but it's somewhere in around there. And the reason is very simple. You do not have conscious access to what your neural system is doing. So it's not surprising that most thought is unconscious. It just is. But what the unconscious thought affects your conscious thought. And your conscious thought tends to be integrated. You look around the room and you see an integrated scene. If you look at what's going on in the brain, it's not integrated. Shape and color are in different parts of the brain, but you see shapes and colors together. There is no color in the world, right? No color at all. That's not, that blue in that shirt is not in the, or in this shirt, is not there in the shirt. It turns out that color depends upon wavelengths that are reflected in the world. But wavelengths aren't colors, and combinations of wavelengths are not colors. You have in your eyes the color cones that are affected by these combinations of wavelengths. Your neural circuit's connected to that, and your brain creates colors differently for men and women because these color cones depend on X chromosomes, and women have two and men have one. And so if you've ever had a debate with anyone of the opposite gender about whether this is blue or green or, or orange or brown, you're both right. That is, you see different things. And some women have a fourth color cone. My wife is an artist. I'm sure she does. They see a million other shades. Right? This is not strange. And birds often have five color cones, right? So I mean, this, when you get into the science of this, it's very, very interesting. You're not, color is not something that is there in the world. It's there in beings that have neural circuits, that have color cones, that have all of this stuff. And it's not just color, it's everything, right? So, this is a very important fact about how this works. Now, let's suppose you have a particular worldview, a whole very, very complex set of concepts that are fixed in your neural circuitry that you use every day to understand what's going on. Right? This constitutes a neural filter. That is, you can only understand what your neural system allows you to understand. If you don't have the capacity in your brain to understand something, what will happen? A fact comes in. What happens? One, if it doesn't fit, one, you may not notice it. Two, you may ignore it. Three, your brain can change it to fit in 80 milliseconds. How do you know this? Right, lots of experiments. I'll give you a simple one that is just about perception. If you have flashing lights that go along really fast, it looks like they're moving, right? The same thing is true of touch. You have a program, a machine that goes and touches you very closely, fast, down your arm, and you feel like somebody's stroking your arm, okay? Now, you program the machine so that it hits the first spot first and then hits one, the second one underneath, and then the third next to it, and so on along the line. What do you feel? You do not feel the second one underneath. You feel the second one in the line when it isn't there. Your brain has changed it to fit the pattern, and it has changed it within 80 milliseconds, within a 12th of a second. And you cannot consciously distinguish a 12th of a second. Right? There's no way you could do that. The same thing happens with information in newspapers and on TV and anything else. You often change what you hear to fit what you understand. That's the neural filter. Or you might be puzzled by it. You might be a kind of person who just says, oh, gee, that's weird. That's puzzling, and notice it, but not know what to do with it, and so on.
Repeat that phrase for them. You change what you hear.
You change what you hear to fit the structure of what your brain allows you to understand. Right? You can change it. Now, some people will just puzzle over it. We'll say, gee, that's weird. I don't know what to make of that, but okay. I'll think about it. Other people won't. Other people will ridicule it. Say, that's ridiculous, and ridicule it. Or attack it if it's threatening. And in politics, all of those happen. You know, those, I'm sure you've noticed every single one of those. And it's important to know why it happens. It is completely natural given the way brains work. Now, there's a reason for this. We're going to get into the difference between liberals and conservatives, but before we get into the details of it, we know that they have different worldviews. And when you have, and what the second thing you know about politics is that all politics is about morality, right? So if someone gets up and says, here's my policy, you should do this, the assumption is it's right, not wrong. They don't say it's evil, but do it. They don't say it doesn't matter, but do it. You know, the assumption is that it's right, not wrong, and it does matter. And if you have two people saying the opposite things, they have different worldviews. They have different senses of right and wrong, different moral worldviews. Now, this is important for a deep reason. You mostly think that you're doing mostly what's right, and you want to do what's right. You generally don't go around trying to do evil things. You try to do things that are right, and you think you've done it right most of the time, unless you screw up and notice it. But the main thing is that is part of your self-definition. Your view of right and wrong is part of the way you understand who you are most deeply. And you try to, and you keep to that. By the way, you don't have a choice about keeping to it, because your brain will keep it to you. It will make sure that that's what's happening. It will structure your actions and your understanding. You don't have to constantly be thinking about it consciously. It will automatically do it unconsciously. But the deepest understanding you have is your understanding of right and wrong. And in politics, that a difference in understanding what's right and wrong is a difference in politics. Right? The first thing about politics is it's about right and wrong. Right? And it's also about who you are, if you're a voter or if you're in office. It is a matter of self-definition. Right? Now, are you likely to vote against your self-definition? No way. Right? What we're going to see is that what happened in the last election was not about populism. It was about self-definition in a very deep way. And it was not noticed by the Democrats at all. Now, there's a reason why many things are not noticed by the Democratic Party. I've been to Senate retreats and congressional retreats and congressional and Senate caucuses and talk to many people who are party officials and party functionaries and so on. Now, here's my view of most of the people I've talked to in the Democratic Party. They are, one, smart, two, honest, three, have decent values, four, work hard, five, are committed to what they're doing. So what goes wrong? What goes wrong is they don't understand their own minds. This is a major problem. They believe in what is called enlightenment reason. Enlightenment reason comes from Descartes in 1650, which was very important in 1650, because before that, people were told they had to listen to the church and they had to listen to the king and all of that stuff, had other people reasoning for them. Descartes said, no, 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 you can reason for yourself. And then he said, well, how do we do this? Well, how do I know? I think, therefore I am. Thought is conscious. He assumed all thought is conscious. We now know it's 98% unconscious. He was a mathematician. He's the guy who invented the Cartesian plane. Right? He said, when I do a proof, I'm thinking consciously. It's like what I see when I do a proof. So thought is logic, and it works by logic. So that if you negate something in logic, it's gone, not there, wiped out. Okay? If you negate something in real life, it ain't in your brain. Think of Richard Nixon saying, I am not a crook. You thought of him as a crook. Don't think of an elephant. You think of an elephant, right? If you negate something, in order to negate it, you have to activate it in your brain. Every time you activate it, it gets stronger. The more you negate it, the stronger it gets, right? And one of the mistakes that is made by a lot of progressives, and you go turn to MSNBC and you'll see it every day, is they will take something that some conservative says, whether it's Trump or some conservative commentator, and they'll repeat it, and then they'll give you the arguments against it. Or there are these things that say myth reality, myth reality. What they're doing when they say the myth is they're strengthening the myth in your brain. So when you argue against something, you're helping the position you're arguing against. Right? Really important thing. Just think, I am not a crook. Okay? Now, that's not what a lot of people think, but it's very important. So when you're writing a story and you have somebody who you know is lying to you and you quote them first and then you give afterwards, you say, oh, and here's the truth, you're helping the guy who's lying to you. Then the question is, what do you do instead? And we'll talk about it, because there are lots of things you can do instead. The short answer to that, which we'll go into in detail, is always frame from the truth. There's a thing of whoever frames first has an advantage. Right? If you frame from the truth, you have an advantage when you start. But just very basic stuff about how brains work. Now, yes?
So you're saying two things. So you're saying, frame first, but you're also saying frame from the truth. What's truth? You know,
you may or may not know it. In many cases, you do know it. Right? If you know it, that's fine. If you don't know it, then we can get into those issues. But if you know it, that's important. Yes. I think we're just about up to you.
But use the example to answer that question, by the way. Use the example that we talked about the other day about using the term debate when it comes to climate crisis, whether there even is a debate or not. That may help answer that question.
Yes, exactly. this is a very crucial point. And by the way, your question is very deep. And it has, let me give you some of the ramifications. In this example from Pruitt. Pruitt says, oh, well, there's a debate about global warming. And, you know, there are some people who believe it's there and some people who don't believe it's there, et cetera. Okay, now, scientific fact is fact and not a debate. It's not a dispute. As soon as you accept that it's a dispute, you assume it's not fact. Right? So what happens is if you accept his statement that that there's a dispute, you're already agreeing with him going against the fact of global warming. You think about that for a minute. To quote him is to accept his view as the truth, just to quote him. Because that quote contains frames. And notice that there are people and there are means... Oh, you know, there's a couple here, and there are 40,000 there. Well, both of them fit the existential quantifier, but the point is there's a difference. Yes. You have to quote it. And so I will tell you how. Well, I had just that question when Brooke Gladstone called me from on the media. And you have a URL for her interview and a discussion of it in that list of URLs that you got. And here's what I told her. I said, look, what happened, by the way, before I do that, I want to go into something else, because she asked me about the tweets. How do you report the president's tweets? So what I did, and what you will find in there, is a nice diagram of the president's types of tweets. I did a study of his types of tweets. Every tweet is strategic. There is no such thing as a random emotional tweet in the middle of the night. They are strategic, and there are four types. Okay? Here's how they go. Number one, preemptive framing. He's going to frame it first. Hillary didn't really get a majority of the votes because 5 million of them were from illegal aliens. Preemptive frame. He's trying to frame this first. Lots of cases of preemptive framing. So if you frame it first, then you have this advantage, and then people can deny, if they try to deny it by saying no, you stay strengthen your frame. Right? So that's number one. Number two is diversion. They're getting close on the Russian issue. We got to attack Meryl Streep. And for 3 days, there's nothing on the news but Meryl Streep, and CNN has a panel of whether celebrities should talk about politics, yes or no, and so on, for days, and they've forgotten about the major issue. So that is a diversion. The third strategy is attack the messenger. The fake news New York Times, et cetera. You attack the mainstream news media who are the enemies of the people, et cetera. You attack the messenger. That's the third. The fourth is a trial balloon. Try out an idea. Maybe everybody should have nuclear weapons. If Japan had nuclear weapons, North Korea might be afraid of them. Maybe we should give nuclear weapons to everybody. Then everybody would be safe, right? And, then what happens? He tried that out, trial balloon. For half a day, they interviewed some people who had written about nuclear proliferation very boringly. And then it was dropped. Yeah? Right? Gone? Well, hey, that was a pretty good trial balloon. And on and on. Those are the four types and combinations of them. And they all work that way. Every single tweet is one of those four types, and often a combination of them. The other thing we found recently was that the same structure works for bombings. We can get to that later. But all the types of bombings that he has are, have the same strategic properties in terms of communication, right? Because Trump is somebody who's trying to control information, and the tweets are a way for him to control that information strategically. Okay? Now the question is, so Brooke Gladstone says, what do you do with that if you're a reporter? Well, the first thing you have to do is say, if it's a diversion, what are you diverting it from? Number one. If it's a preemptive frame and you know it's a lie, is there a corresponding frame that you know is a truth? Right? You always start out with the relevant truth that you know, if there is a truth that you know. And it, you always start out with the most important thing in context. If it's the Russians, or if it's financial wheeler dealing, or if it's whatever it is, you always start out with the important stuff and what is known about it. Then if there's a diversion, you say there's been an attempt to divert us from this. And in the diversion, you tell, if there's truths about that, you know, you tell those. At that point, you bring in the tweet or whatever, the statement, and you quote it. And then you say, as you see, this doesn't fit what we know to be the situation. And then you go back to what's important. And you have quoted it, you've said it, you've said what is going on, and you've told the truth. Now, that is not the way journalism is taught. When I told this to Ari Melber at at MSNBC, he would say, oh, that's a unique perspective. You know, it's like, I couldn't do that. Why not? Because it's not what you're taught in journalism school, and it's not what has been done. But it, because it's not what has been done, the press can be manipulated. So the question is, are you going to continue to allow this manipulation? Because otherwise, you will allow the manipulation.
This is Tony's question, and I think I'd like to get some others involved in it, because I actually think it's at the very core of what we're going to talk about today, is how would you appropriately frame, or how would you penetrate to the truth in a story when there are so many other influences on what you can do, what's even possible for you to do with the material you're given for any particular story. Another one of those pressures, of course, is what's the dominant narrative out of that story that your editors are going to see through the course of the day or the hour. And if you come in with a little bit more what's going to look like an interpretive piece, if you sort of begin with the truth and not say with Pruitt's statement that there's a debate over climate science, that's not going to fit what's getting reported on cable news the hour you turn in your story. So how do we cope with that? So I'd like, before we get to the exercise even, I'd like to open the floor and get y'all's thoughts or questions or concerns that kind of go deeper into Tony's question up here, because I think that's at the very center. Yes.
The first one, you know, if you know, for example, that, you know, climate change is real, fine. If you know how it works, you know, that carbon dioxide reflects heat. The more of it, the more reflection you get in the atmosphere. You know, things like that. Very simple stuff of that sort that matter, that are crucial beyond this. Most people don't even know that about carbon dioxide. You say, well, carbon dioxide is sort of nice for trees. You know, what's wrong with carbon dioxide? Okay? There are certain scientific facts that turn out to be crucial in your stories. And people are not used to putting science into a story. And you don't have, but it can be done in a way where it's a sentence or two, and you go on. But that sentence or two may be the crucial thing that people learn from this story.
Or any other questions or yes?
I have an editor who's constantly asking me to find the Republican to oppose what the Democrat is saying. But if I call balance, I sometimes argue with false frequency. So if I write a story about climate policy, he wants me to find someone who's against it and say why. And I think there's, you know, people on the lead to be against policy, but not about climate. So it becomes this struggle of trying to be fair.
There's a metaphor that fairness is balance. It's a crazy metaphor, and it's deadly.
Yeah, I want to say that we need to have about 100 of these sessions with editors too. So that would be a huge help, wouldn't it? It's a difficult practical world problem that we're not going to be able to overnight change the way you're able to frame stories to address that, among other issues, I think. All we could do is keep pushing and pushing and trying and trying. I'll just add something to what George said. That can be done. You quote both sides, but you set the frame accurately. So I don't want to jump ahead on this exercise, but I'll explain more when I get to the Scott Pruitt part about how you might be able. I'm going to ask your thoughts on how you might do that. But there are ways of setting the frame of a story that aim at the truth before you've got to get into the equivalent quotes. That'll, in the back of the room?
You have to give historical background and context. But the thing, this question is, what is, all right, there's a notion of a lead, where the lead is what is new. And what you can say that something like, given the background that we have, an interesting thing has come in from so-and-so who has, you know, said spoken recently. The background is this. And you go on, and then you get to what he said, what they said in context. I mean, there are ways around this of saying what you have to do, and why context is crucial, why history is crucial, why something changes history, where they have to know the history.
Yeah, let me say too. I mean, this is another place that's going to take time to get to. That's a very. I mean, that's what I mean by. If Scott Pruitt says something and it's on CNN, your editor's going to see it and wonder why you don't have the same exact lead. He says something new. Over time, this has to change because, believe me, I have been on the side of things where I manipulate the press simply by saying something new. I mean, Donald Trump is a master at this. He dominates headlines by saying something brand spanking and usually outrageously new, right? So he guarantees himself the lead and the headline. It's a way of manipulating the press that the press should see through, but we have 100 or more years of history where the press just reports what is new. And what we're suggesting is that you at least got to try to get some context high up in the story if you can't avoid the editor and the headline writer's demand that you do the new. Actually, when I searched for these quotes, that wasn't the case. But I don't want to get ahead because I want you all to do an exercise with it. So if I could come back to that. Yes, many did, but many, I'll answer that question specifically. But many said, Pruitt says X. The science is this and this. But they've already set the frame in terms of, say, there is a debate and he's on one side of the debate. Then they do, but they enjoy writing the story that way in that particular instance of he's saying that the human causes of climate change may not be, are up for debate. And that becomes the lead. And then there's a lot of questioning because they love to go on and say the science is this, this, and this, but they've already set the frame that there's a debate about it.
As soon as you set the frame that there's a debate about it, then the science is gone. The science loses instantly. And I'm not either, as you may have noticed. You know, that is, if you're using enlightenment reason, you got a problem. I'm trying to shift it to not have you being in a situation where you're manipulated into saying to communicating the opposite of what you know to be true. If you are in a situation where you're being manipulated into saying the opposite, into allowing the other guy's frame to dominate, then you're being manipulated. Our job here is to point out to you when you're being manipulated and to give you some idea of how to get out of it.
There are plenty of examples. I believe the facts of climate sort of tend toward the progressive side, and I just happen to think that's a fact. So, but there are subjects we could bring up and talk about where the framing from the left would be the propaganda we're trying to see through. I mean, the biggest example over the last couple of decades, I think, was all the framing that Clinton did over welfare reform, for instance. It was based on inaccurate information from the very beginning, but it was framed in a way that made it more popular than it probably should have been. If you had applied these principles we're talking about in that instance, one, the reporting probably would have been more accurate. The outcome might have been different. So, yes, because this the subject so much is environmental issues, they tend to skew this way, but that's not what we're about. I try to look at it from my old life as a journalist, really, in this instance. And it's even uncomfortable for me right now because I'm not sure I have the exact answer.
You don't, and this is very, we're going to get there momentarily, and then it gets really hard. That's what an alternative fact is. When Kellyanne Conway said there's an alternative fact, what she meant is, given this worldview, this has to be the truth. It follows from the worldview. And unless I change my whole moral worldview, my whole idea of not only who I am, but who everybody who voted for Trump is, this would just has to be true. So it has to be a fact, given the worldview. So when that's what these alternative facts are. And sometimes, you have things that don't fit your worldview, and you better watch it. I'll give you examples of that. Now, I think one of the things we have to get into is what conservative and progressive thought is about, what the worldviews are, what the consequences of those are. And then before that, I want to get into one more thing. What the hell is a moderate? And it's very important from the point of view of the brain, what is a moderate? Right? A moderate conservative is somebody who has some progressive views on some issues or other. A moderate progressive is somebody who has some conservative views on some issues or other, and they vary from person to person. So a moderate is somebody who has a major view and a minor view on some issues. Now, if those worldviews contradict each other, if progressive and conservative views are contradictory, how can you have two contradictory worldviews in the same brain? Ever worry about that? I do. That's my job. Now, and the answer is simple. It comes from the first week of neuroscience. There's a phenomenon called mutual inhibition, where the activation of where two things that contradict each other inhibit each other, and whichever is stronger at a given time overrides the other in a given context. Now, to give you a feel for mutual inhibition, it's in every muscle in your body. Every muscle in your body has another muscle paired with it. So you have flexor muscles and extensor muscles. Those muscles are related by mutual inhibition. If you tense your tensor muscle, you're relaxing the extensor. If you tense the extensor by doing like that, you're relaxing the flexor. That is, every single muscle in your body is paired with another muscle so that the activation of one inhibits the other. That is everywhere in your whole body. It's also in your brain, when you have contradictory ideas. And that is what's going on in this case. Now, it turns out that conservatives figured out how to use this. And they figured it out roughly around 1994. What they did was the following. The Leadership Institute in Virginia, as I'm sure you all know about the Leadership Institute, or don't you? Every reporter must know about the Leadership Institute. Okay, go online, look it up. The Leadership Institute was set up in the 90s, around that time, when Gingrich was trying to get rid of all of the moderates in the Republican Party. And this was financed by extremely conservative Republicans. And what they did was get people who were going to be conservative and Republican leaders from around the country down to the age of 15 in summer camps for very cheap or free to be trained over a period of time to think and talk conservative. And then they were kept on a listserv, and they were sent every day talking points. And then there were booking agencies to book them on radio, TV, in various venues like, trade associations or high schools or whatever, all around the country. After 20 years, the Leadership Institute in 2014 had a celebration. They had trained 159,000 of such folks. Think of them spread out through that red state map, all right, out there, thinking and talking conservative every day, booked every day on their local radio and TV, saying the same thing over and over and over for 20 years. What does that mean? When you repeat something, but when you have language, language means something. You know, you say something, it has a meaning. Example, on George W. Bush's first day in office, he talked about tax relief. Well, what does that mean? Relief says there's some affliction and you want that's bad and harming you and hurting you, and you want to be relieved from it, and someone who relieves you is a good guy, and someone who wants it to continue is a bad guy trying to harm you. Tax relief is a metaphor. It says taxation is that affliction. So somebody who is for tax relief, for getting rid of taxes, is the good guy, and anybody who wants to keep the taxes or increase taxes on the rich is a bad guy. Tax relief. You repeat it every day, day after day after day, and soon the New York Times on the front page talks about tax relief. And very soon you have Democrats talking about tax relief for the middle class. And they've adopted the worldview of the right. Absolutely. You got it. A perfect example.
One more of this after this little exercise. And as I enter this, there's a really important point I want to make, that there's no real answer in the analysis you're going to do in these two quotes at the moment. But I want to suggest that there's, by observing the process by which you're story is manipulated and your relationship to that and how you can overcome it, just the process of stepping back and observing that as you think about it is going to help reframe towards the truth. In this instance and in any other one that you might have to cover, it's sort of like phenomenological bracketing. It's even a little bit like Buddhist meditation, where you sort of observe yourself as you go through the process. Just doing that is the right approach to take. So the outcome at this point, there's not going to be any right or wrong on this exercise. We'll take a few minutes to do. But the idea of thinking through how you would penetrate the raw material you're given, like in any daily news story, and how would you report the truth, that process is beneficial to the outcome, in my opinion. So why don't we take, what do you think, 15 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes? Look at these quotes. You're assigned to do the story on Scott Pruitt on climate change. I've provided you with quotes both for and against that. You can either analyze it. You can attempt to write a lead. You can critique either side of the quotes, any one of those three approaches that this would take, and then we'll call on you to report to all of us when we're done. Any questions about that? Yes. Well, I was thinking you could do it if you want to discuss it at the tables. Yeah, that'll be fine. That might be a little bit noisy in the room this small, but but you could discuss it amongst yourselves and do one report out of the table if you'd like, or do it individually. Either way, you can either do like the lead of a story, right? where you would try to get to the truth of this behind these two sides of the quotes. You can analyze what you think is being done to you by the quotes, or you can just critique the approach, any one of those three. The idea is to get you thinking through how would you penetrate to the truth given the quotes that you just successfully assembled from the newsmakers.